Hello. Welcome to the Unity Spiritual Center of Albuquerque podcast featuring the Reverend Gordon Kyler or occasionally a guest speaker. You can find us online at uscabq.org or by searching for Unity Spiritual Center Albuquerque on Facebook or YouTube. You can visit us in person at 9800 Candelaria Road Northeast in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Today's special guest is Michael Small.
All right, here we go. We're here. We're at the end. Our 12 Powers, Reel to Reel, Summer Series. And I don't know about you, but I really learned a lot in the last several weeks about power and our powers and how we can navigate through life and weave them together. I think this is really, this is the cherry on top, I think. This is life. And we're looking at life through the lens of a wonderful life. You know, life is our ability to energize and animate. It is the quality of vitality. Life is divine, spiritual, and the source of God and spirit. The river of life is within man in his spiritual consciousness. We can be truly quickened with new life and vitalized in mind and body only by consciously contacting spirit. This contact is made through prayer, meditation, good works. Charles Fillmore said in his revealing word, and he said that Jesus said, "I have come so that you may have life." What? One more time? You guys been paying attention. I love it. So what does it mean to have abundant life? The dictionary defines abundant as more than enough, very plentiful, abounding in, or rich. Do you have life abundantly? Or are you always waiting for life to appear? Are you willing to see that we have enough? In Unity, we believe that heaven and hell are not out there in the afterlife. But it's right here, right now. And that we create them with our thoughts and our actions. We create heaven when we cooperate with life by aligning our strengths and our gifts and demonstrating the fullness of our potential. We create hell when we don't. We create heaven when we allow life to flow through us with ease. And we create hell when we fight life. And then life becomes very hard, wouldn't you agree? We create heaven when we become grateful for everything we have, blessing it and blessing our journey, and we create hell when nothing we have fulfills us, when nothing is enough. Cora Diedrich Fillmore, Charles Fillmore's second wife, observed, "Without the desire for greater understanding of life, without the desire for greater degree of life's activity, we shall never strive for the unfulfillment of the soul." But in grasping these spiritual powers, we should not make hard work of it. Often, metaphysicians are so bent on their spiritual demonstrations that they squeeze the joy and freedom out of life. How many of us are grasping of everything that we think life has to offer us? But instead, what we're doing is we're squeezing the joy and freedom out of our lives. In her book, My Grandfather's Blessing, by Dr. Rachel Naomi Riemann, has an entire section of stories and essays entitled Befriending Life. She introduces these sections and with thoughts such as, "Befriending life is less a matter of knowledge than a question of wisdom. It is not about mastering life or controlling it. It exerts our will, or even exerting our will over it, no matter how intentional we may be. Befriending life is more about harmlessness than it is about controlling. Harmlessness requires connection. It means listening to life from the place in us that is connected to the wholeness around us. The place in us that is also whole. The wisdom to befriend life will find us whether or not we pursue it. We may live in a familiar circle of experiences for many years among the attitudes and beliefs and places and relationships that define our everyday world. But it is only a matter of time until something invites us or requires us to reach beyond the familiar, to experience something never before felt or seen, something perhaps not even imaginable. Such experiences can profoundly shift our understanding of the world, breaking open new perspectives and drawing us closer to our true selves. These moments often arise through suffering and joy, each serving as a gateway to a deeper self-awareness and spiritual growth. Both of those will leave us wiser. Befriending life may enable us to solve some of life's problems. It has become a common understanding that most problems cannot be solved by approaching them with the same consciousness that we create them in the first place with. It is doubtful that the solution to our present suffering will lie in greater technology and greater experiences. Our very survival requires that we do something new, something simple and more human, that we become open beyond our expertise, that we learn to live closer to life, the life in us and the life around us, and remember that we are serving with our technology and our experiences, that we pay enough attention to learn to trust life. Coral Fillmore said it this way: life is progress, attainment, and mastery, and every spiritual realization makes finer and stronger, more beautiful the texture of the soul. Life is our ability to stay young at heart. It is our capacity to shift the attention from the quantity of our life to the quality of our life. It's our ability to maintain our innocence and our joy for life, the sense of, isn't life great? To be young at heart means that we don't allow suffering to get in the way of our living. It means to keep an open mind, or a beginner's mind, as they say in Buddhism. This means that we always will, or we're willing to start fresh, to do it in a new way, truly a new way, not the old way in different clothing. This distinction is the difference between true transformation and mere translation. Remember what Cora Fillmore said earlier: but in grasping these spiritual powers, we should not make hard work of it. Life becomes hard when we fight these lessons. It's about our choice. It's about how we choose to see and experience life. Is it a struggle or is it a joy? Is it a curse or a blessing? Remember the third principle. We believe that our thoughts and feelings create our life. How we're showing up is a reflection of these thoughts and feelings. Here's an interesting exercise to do this week. Set a timer on either your watch, your computer, your phone, or your stove for 15 minutes. And when it dings, stop what you're doing and observe your thoughts. What do you see? What are the thoughts telling you? Are your thoughts love or fear? If you act on your thoughts at that moment, what would you create? Here's a Hebrew word meaning to life. Lachim uses as a toast. Dr. Raymond relates the story of her grandfather's teaching her the meaning of the word. She asked him once, "Is it to have a happy life, Grandpa?" And he shakes his head, "No." "Is it just to live life?" He told her, "No." At first, this didn't make sense to her, and she struggled to understand his meaning. "Is it like a prayer?" she asked. "Oh, no," he told her. "We pray for things we don't have. We already have life." She was puzzled about this for some time. "Is it written in the Bible, Grandpa?" "No. Neshamala is written in our hearts, in people's hearts." Seeing the confusion in her face, he told her that Lachim means no matter what difficult life brings, no matter how hard or painful or unfair life is holy and worthy of celebration. Even the wine is sweet to remind us that life is always a blessing. That brings us to our movie, It's a Wonderful Life. The movie was originally released in 1946 after World War II had ended. It starred Jimmy Stewart and Donna Reed and was directed by Frank Capra. What was it? Capra, thank you. When it first came out, it was not warmly received. People wanted a happy, cheery Christmas movie, and they didn't understand the message. It took a while, but over time, especially it was after it was re-released, a couple decades later, people were in a different place and embraced the movie. It's now considered one of the best films ever made. The movie tells the story of George Bailey's life as told from an angel's perspective. We first meet George in person on a bridge where he's about to kill himself. You can see why people weren't really into the movie when it first came out. God and the angels are in heaven talking about George, saying that everyone is asking us to pray. Please pray for George Bailey. The angel Clarence is sent down to help George, so he starts by seeing George's life from the beginning. The first half of the movie is basically extended flashbacks, which demonstrates that life can only be understood if you go backwards, but you have to live it forwards. In order to understand where George is going, we have to understand where he's been. We see George as a young boy saving his brother Harry after falling through the ice in the pond. We see him a little bit older and George, excuse me, we see him a little bit older and George, but still a boy, preventing the pharmacist, Mr. Gower, from accidentally poisoning a young child. Mr. Gower had just gotten terrible news about his son in the war and has a lot of grief going on, and he puts the wrong medicine into the pill and was about to send it off to the young boy when George stopped him from this happening and saved the young boy's life and Mr. Gower's career. Later, we find George Bailey on the brink of pursuing his lifelong dreams of traveling to Europe and attending college. However, his plans came to a halt when his father unexpectedly dies from a stroke, leaving the family building and loan business in jeopardy. George, driven by a strong sense of duty and loyalty, chose to stay behind and manage the business, sacrificing his personal aspirations to support his family and community. Then 4 years later, we see George again staying home as his brother Harry returns home from college. Poignancy of this is that George gave Harry all the money he had saved up to travel so that Harry could go away for college. George was planning on taking off as soon as Harry got home, but when Harry got home, he came with a new wife and a new job, and with his new wife's father, Once again, George stayed home in Bedford Falls. Eventually, he married his childhood sweetheart, Mary, and then had four children. And then again, we see George staying home as everybody else goes off to war. When George jumped into the icy pond to save his brother earlier from drowning, he caught a severe illness that left him deaf in one ear. This injury would prevent him from serving in the military during World War II. Unlike his brother, Harry, who went on to become a war hero, George's act of bravery did not only save his brother's life, but also set the course of his own, barring from him joining the armed forces and instead keeping him rooted in Bedford Falls. This twist of fate underscores the theme of sacrifice and how George's choices, often made out of selfishness, continue to shape his life path in unexpected ways. As he said, he was stuck at home, even when everyone else was going away to war. So George fought the war, and watching George's life, in retrospect, he looks to us as George has had a wonderful life, a wonderful family, and a wonderful wife, and a job where he helps people. Everybody loves George, but George doesn't see it that way. Every step of the way, what he wants most of all was to leave Bedford Falls. Every step of the way, he wants to leave his life. As he said to his father before he died, "I want to shake the dust off this crummy little town off my shoes. I couldn't face being cooped up in the rest of my life in the shabby little office. I go crazy. I want to do something big, something important." And his father very, very quietly replies, it's the deep in the race for a man to want his roof and his walls and his fireplace. And we're helping him to get those things in a shabby little office. What George didn't understand, and what so many of us take for granted, it takes a lifetime to learn, is that we are really having a wonderful life right now, right here, where we're at. I saw a meme on Facebook the other day that got me thinking. It was a picture of an obviously impoverished area. The words on the bottom of the picture said, "Always remember the life you're complaining about is always a dream to some." As George was standing on the bridge preparing to jump, he had forgotten in that moment, complete despair, what a difference he has made in the lives of many people. Joseph Campbell says it this way: "We must be willing to let go of life. We have the life we plan so as to accept the life that is waiting for us. Sometimes we need help doing that, like George and Clarence and Mary and the entire town of Bedford. Except the grumpy old Potter, Mr. Potter, was the bank president. He was grumpy and cynical and selfish and greedy. And one of the initial objects to this movie, objects to the movies, was that at the end, Mr. Potter didn't get punished for what he did. Apparently, the producers of the movie were not familiar with the concept of karma." One of the things I love about Hallmark Christmas movies is that I know there's going to be a happy ending and that all the bad guys get what they deserve at the end. That doesn't happen in A Wonderful Life. We are left with the understanding that Mr. Potter got away for stealing $8,000 from Uncle Billy. But I want to put a little spin on the greedy, selfish, mean old Grinch, Mr. Potter. Yes, he was miserable and mean and selfish and conniving, but in a very real way, it was Mr. Potter who created who George was. Mr. Potter's selfishness propelled George to be generous. And if Mr. Potter hadn't attempted to take over the building and loan when George's dad died, George wouldn't have stayed there. He would have taken over the business. In retrospect, we could see that it was a great opportunity for George, although he didn't see it at the time. But he did a lot of good, and that's that building alone, all because Mr. Potter was trying to take it over. And Mr. Potter, stealing the $8,000 from Uncle Billy, gave Bedford Falls the chance to show George how much the town really meant to him, or they meant to George. Mr. Potter's hard work made George's big heart even more obvious. So back to the needing help to see what's happening, to what's wonderful lives we have. I'll go back. So back to the needy help to see what the wonderful life we all have. This leads us to Clarence, who is an angel second class. More than anything, Clarence wants to earn his wings, which we learn very early on that the movie is as God and the senior angels in the hierarchy of angels in Christmas movie land were deciding who to send to Earth to help George. So Clarence, like George, needed help needing to see the truth of his life and how truly wonderful it was. George needed to help see that he did not have to leave Bedford Falls to have an amazing life. What George saw was the real journey is in how much or how well we have loved and lived. George traveled into the hearts and lives of the people of Bedford Falls and made a difference for them right there where he was. Mother Teresa taught, "What I do, you cannot do. What you do, I cannot do." The needs are so great, and none of us, including me, can do great jobs or great things, but we can do small things with great love. Together, we can do something wonderful. Never doubt that the differences you make is wonderful. Who are you, and what are you bringing makes a difference. George needed Clarence to help him see what a wonderful life he had. And George needed Clarence and Mary and the people of Bedford Falls to see all the wonderful small acts that he has done that added up to a great, wonderful life. In the Wonderful Life book, we read, "It's a Wonderful Life, the story of an ordinary man. George is not brilliant or grand or heroic in the usual sense of these words. He does not invent things or is elected to office, or he does not make money, win contests, or circumnavigate the world. He does not compose music, and he doesn't even invest in plastic. And yet what makes George touch us is that he hates his ordinariness and rails against it. It's not that he doesn't feel his true self. He feels something grand and brilliant on the inside. His heroic self is wanting to come out, and what he longs for is a chance to express it, a place to let it flow. It's not that George Bailey feels it like a common man, and that makes him and us all identify with him with love and love for him. He seeks to transcend his ordinary existence because inside he knows he's extraordinary. His journey is about embracing that inner greatness and letting it shine beyond every day. It's a Wonderful Life is a paradox. It's present. The perfect small town life shows its darker potential. It gives us a hero who loves the perfect life but hates it. It's a film of contradictions where everyone is oblivious and carries its own opposite. It's present itself as a warm romantic comedy, yet at its heart lies the darkness of the film noir. It's wonderful. Life contains truth, but it contains within itself the impossibilities of its own truth. It's about dreams that turn into nightmares and the dreams that turns into dreams. It provides a victory, but it's not without defeat. The leading character wins, but he also loses, but he also wins. In the end, nothing changes for him, nothing except everything. He does not leave Bedford Falls, but he accepts the meaning of his life. It's a Wonderful Life was actually based on a short story by Philip Van Dornster. Okay. It was called The Greatest Gift, and the promo for it was that in the story and in the movie, George sees that his life is the greatest gift. That's true, and I also believe that George received the gift of seeing what difference he had made. Now, before I show the clip, George is standing on the bridge, and he's looking for Clarence, the angel, and his life has just began to change, and he's praying to God because he doesn't know that he's still alive. Play the clip. That's an amazing scene, and that scene really hit home with me because it brought me back to a time when my life was completely falling apart. Everything was crashing down around me. And I captured that turning point in my book because it was a pivotal moment in my journey. I remember that one night vividly when tears streaming down my face as I prayed to God, asking for help, anything that would get me out of this mess that I found myself in and just change the situation. And let me say that within 6 months, my life completely changed. Thank you. It was like that knob coming off in George's hand. And instead of being angry with it, instead of seeing it as just one piece of evidence that how crummy life could be, George picked up that knob and he kissed it. Sorry. That was my favorite scene because, like George in that pivotal moment, I didn't just accept what was happening. I chose to surrender my life, embracing a deep sense of purpose and trust. George began to love his life. He befriended life. He became grateful for the crummy old house and that crummy old knob and that crummy old building and loan. And in that moment when he kissed that knob, he fell in love with his life. And he saw that he truly had a wonderful life, and he became grateful of it. That's the biggest gift. Becoming grateful for the life we have, even the crummy parts. Being willing to see everyone and everything in life is a blessing. To be blessed, to see the good in all, everyone, everything, every situation, and every opportunity for us to become grateful for us to see what truly, truly wonderful life has. To be deeply, wonderfully grateful for all life, to love the lives we're living, to know that no matter how difficult life brings, or the difficulties that life brings, no matter how hard the pain or unfair life is holy and worthy of celebration. That, my friends, is the greatest gift. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed today's message. If you would like to support this podcast, you may do so at uscabq.org.